Hey everybody, this is Sandra. Welcome to show number 4 of Toon Talk. I recorded today's show over Christmas last year with Tal Schwartzman, previously of DreamWorks and currently at a studio we can't mention, but you can check out his Twitter account. I linked it below. Tal's background is truly inspiring. He's someone who's worked incredibly hard to be as talented as he is. You only need to spend a few moments talking to Tal to be utterly convinced of his dedication and passion for animation. Perhaps most well known for his work on Sophie and Rise of the Guardians, Tal also worked on Ice Age, Kung Fu Panda 1 and 2, Shrek Forever After, and How to Train Your Dragon 2. He's currently working on a very exciting movie he'll be able to talk about later in the year. I was thrilled to get Tal on the show. He tells it as it is with a twist of humour which makes for very interesting conversation. Tal hosts his own podcasts over on a site animation-addicts.com, so check those out. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy today's show with the exceptionally talented Tal Schwartzman. Anywho, will we get going?
Sure. How do you do this again? Is it transcribed or is this like a recorded audio?
Oh, no, this is recorded audio.
Okay. You already started recording?
I have, but don't worry. Everything's going to be kept in confidence, and I'll send it to you to say, okay, you know, before I send
awesome.
It out there.
Yeah, all right, that's cool. Let's get started then. It's no problem then.
So I know it's been covered by the iAnimate podcast about how you got to Blue Sky and how you got to DreamWorks, but I wanted to start a little bit before that and go back to what made you want to become an animator.
Oddly enough, I grew up mainly, especially in my youth, watching TV overseas. So I was in Israel most of the time in the beginning, and there wasn't a lot of TV. I mean, there was like basically one channel over there, and it just had like the summer cartoons, and they were like Transformers and the original ones, and there was some, I don't know if it was like a Dutch or Swedish TV show called Nils Holgersson. And then there was a few other ones that came from Japan and a few French ones. So those were the first things that I was kind of introduced to. And I was really into that. Like, I loved drawing. I was trying to draw really young. I would say I was doing it very successfully. my mom would help me a lot. And it would start by me basically kind of trying to reproduce what I saw on TV. It didn't go very well at the beginning, but then I think the first animated movie I saw, I think was a Disney film. I'm still trying to find this out. I think it was Fox and the Hound, and it was just that there wasn't a lot of movies that played there that came from the States in Israel, especially not the Disney ones. You know how they were released out of the vault?
Yeah.
That wasn't like a common occurrence in Israel, so I wasn't getting the Disney classics, which I didn't even see until way later in my teens. So I think like Fox and the Hound might have been one of the first, or the first I saw in the theater. And then I saw some, you know, bad ones from other places. But that's what kind of inspired me. And I really got into that. And I think that's where the idea of animation, like drawing, I really got into. I didn't understand that people made cartoons, I think. Like animation, like there were people that actually did it for a living. I kind of just dug the fact that they were cartoons and I got to draw them. And then I honestly don't remember what it was, but I think it's when I did come to California in fourth grade or fifth grade. There was just a lot more exposure to Disney animation and a lot of that stuff. And I think I honestly can't remember what it was that I kind of put one and one together. And it was like, oh, these guys do this. And then it was like, how do I do this? And my parents, especially my mom, was really cool about supporting me. She finally was like, oh, Tal is really good at this. Let's have him focus on this. And she was really supportive and, you know, got me all these Disney books, of, you know, characters that I got to draw. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of information out there. It wasn't like, oh, don't draw Disney characters, do life drawings. I didn't know any of that stuff. I was just, like, learning to draw through drawing those characters.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think it was like the late 80s, a lot more animation started coming out, much like the one behind you, American Tail, you know, Land Before Time, Basil of Baker Street, you know, all that stuff was coming out, and then it was like, animation was popular again, and it was cool, and it was cool to be into it, and I was loving it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I gotta do this. This is like a singular thought, like, this is everything I plan to do in life.
What age were you? What, fourth grade? Did you say? Or
I moved back to LA, to California. It was the middle of fourth grade, I think. Yeah.
We don't have fourth grade here. What age would that be? I mean, we don't call it fourth grade. I don't know what that is.
Oh, now you stuck me. to say, was it nine?
Nine. Oh.
Eight.
It was about the same age for me, too. That's when I saw this movie behind me here. It seems that you went straight from college to work for Disc Inn. Is that right?
So what happened was when I when college ended, I'd sent my portfolio around, and unfortunately in 2000, all the 2D studios were shut down. Like, yeah. 3D was out there already. I just wasn't really into, like, it was okay to see CG, but I wasn't really into it. It was kind of like, oh, that's cute. Someone found a computer. Like, that was my initial feeling. Like, someone found a computer. Oh, that's really cute. I was still really into the drawing aspect of it. You know, I really loved anime, like, just drawing it. I thought it was, you know, charming and beautiful, and just, it had its own thing. And, like, all the studios were basically closing. I think that summer I was calling up Fox Animation in Arizona. I think they were in Phoenix. And I was like, oh, I want to send my portfolio down. And they're like, yeah, everybody's gone home. And I'm like, okay, when are they going to be back? And they're like, I don't think they're coming back. And then followed a few weeks later, like, Disney Paris was shut down, and Tokyo, and Australia was still going, maybe. So there wasn't a lot of 2D stuff. I did a little bit of freelance work in Toronto, and then I kind of worked back to Israel because I was like a broke art. I was like a broke art student, so I didn't really have anything else going. So I was trying to find something.
You went back to Israel, so you broke up there. Did you go back?
Yeah, I went back to Israel like later that summer, towards the beginning of. Well, this was way at the end of the summer, so towards the end of the year, and then in Israel at the time they were really into the .com era, like the tech boom was booming.
All right, okay.
So a lot of CG stuff that was implemented or somehow implemented into like online internet stuff was going on.
Mm.
But I wasn't really interested in that. I was kind of like, I just want to do 2D. I got involved in some stuff that was kind of like, I'm not interested in this. And then I just got to Disc Inn, and I did some TV show work and some freelance commercials and some stuff for Spain, assistant animation work. And it was okay, but the work was really scarce. Like, there was almost no 2D being done.
Yeah.
There was no growth. And then luckily, might have been 2 years later, I want to say, after bouncing around a little bit, I landed IDT.
Mm.
And I was kind of like, it was interesting because it was an American company which was opening up a branch in Israel. So I was like, okay, their thinking might be closer to what I'm used to, being an American, a half American. So I'm like, okay, this could be great. So what I did is I kind of decided I'll sit down and I taught myself the CG pipeline as best I could. Basically, it was opening up 3D Max, 3D Studio Max, I think it was version 4. I mean, just went through all the tutorials, and I just did all of it from, like, taught myself how to model polys and, like, splines, and then do, like, texturing and UV wrapping and rigging, and then animate fully on in the computer, and then even do the render. Just, not that it was beautiful by any, you know, it was probably horrendous looking, even then, not even today, just probably even then. But it was just something that you need to know, I think, the pipeline. Like, in 2D, when you go to school, they teach you, like, the whole workflow, right? You're supposed to learn how to do, at least in school, they teach you how to do layouts and character design and storyboarding and, you know, animation, cleanup and color. They teach you how to do all that stuff, so you have a grasp of what a 2D film or a 2D production pipeline would be like.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, the mentality of teaching myself that pipeline was the same thing, so it was kind of like, okay, I need to learn this. And I thought that time around, it grounded me a little bit more, and I felt a little bit more connected with CG. And then after that, I kind of never looked back too much.
What was on your reel for the too much? What was on your reel, the first one you sent out to Disc Inn, or the one that you're sending around?
To where, I'm sorry?
Disc Inn, or, you know, your first one out of college. What was on your reel?
Oh, it was just my student work. The Disc Inn was literally my student film with some student exercises for my third year. And at Sheridan, it was all the same ones. It was like a couple of physical run and jumps, and then our short film could have had dialogue, didn't have to have dialogue. I don't think I even had dialogue in my reel. It was just some of that stuff and a lot of life drawing.
Okay.
That was primarily it, yeah.
It's amazing what passes for a reel back then as to now. It's kind of a big difference.
I mean, it's like I tell my students, you're well aware of that. It's just that the expectations from us at the day was very different because when you come out of school, like, oh, in 2D especially, you'd spend, if you're lucky, maybe 2 years, 3 years in cleanup before you worked out to animation, if you were lucky. Today, it's like you're at school, you have to hit the ground running as a pro animator and produce 5 to 6 feet a week.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's the standards are just a little bit.
Do you remember what it was like starting at Blue Sky in your first feature, how you might have felt the first few days?
I was really excited. I think it was kind of like I finally made it. I was like, oh, this is feature animation. And I mean, it was interesting because I didn't know anything about feature animation. Blue Sky is one of the top, I think, four big studios in the States, in the world, that produced just nothing but feature animation. That's just their basic business, right?
Yeah.
So I remember emailing some of the other temp guys over there with me. Take a moment, enjoy the fact that you're working on something insane that's going to be viewed by millions of people. I was in this delirious day, like, this is, you know, feature animation, yay. Not realizing the contrast between the artistic side of, like, yay, we're making animated movies, to production needs and, you know, the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. So, my experience was mixed, I think, at that time, and I think partly it was my fault because I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
Nobody ever prepares you for that. Like, the school I went to, it was good at teaching you how to draw. It didn't prepare you for what the industry is really like. And the books that are written are all, they're great and informative, but they kind of just rosy-colored glasses, you know, of what's out there, but not reality. It's sometimes, if you're not aware, and you're, like, very much into the craft of it and not anything else, that stuff can take you a little bit, you know, because, you know, take you over a little bit, and you kind of get swept away, and it surprises you.
Yeah, it can be rough. So you spent about 6-7 years at DreamWorks, and that would have made you pretty comfortable with your thinking, where are you going with this? I can see it in your eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. It would have made you pretty comfortable with the way things are going there, production pipeline-wise, and what they expect from your blocking and so on and so forth. So I'm wondering what it was like, the changeover from DreamWorks to your current studio, where they have a very different way of approaching shots. Was it hard for you to find your feet?
Even at DreamWorks, it was different because when I started working there, like you said, it was seven and a half years ago, it was a very different studio. So the expectations for the artists was also very different.
Right.
And I think how people showed with their work and what they showed had evolved over that year. I mean, it's actually interesting to see what would have passed for blocking 7 years ago and what passes for blocking today at DreamWorks.
Can you explain?
At the time, you know, it's fine. It's like, yeah, at the time, like, I would have blocked when I first got there. I probably would have blocked and hit, you know, an accent on the keys. So, you know, it would be, I would have a keyframe. It could be, you know, 4 frames apart or 10 to 12 frames apart. And I just put down the keyframes that I thought were important for the shot. And I worked like that for a long time. I worked like that through, Panda and Monsters vs. Aliens, and then Shrek 4. So, you know, 3 films, which adds up to around 4 years, probably 5 years. That's probably 4 years. And then on Panda 2, it just became a situation where I noticed, especially on Shrek, that I could see what I was blocking. Like, I could see what it was blocking because I knew what it was supposed to look like. I knew what the reference looked like, and I knew what it's going to end up looking like. But, excuse me, not always could the supervisor, director, or whomever could 100% understand what I'm showing them, meaning that they would see it, but not necessarily would they know exactly what the final result would be, meaning that they would fill in the empty, let's say, the held frames with what they thought was going to be there, not what was really going to be there.
Yeah.
So always when I showed for final, it was a bit of a surprise that some of the notes would be like, well, no, that's what I showed for my blocking. I don't understand why you don't understand what this is if this is what you saw. So I just became a lot more, I think, and not me, it just became much more prevalent throughout the studio that blocking basically meant everything was pretty detailed on. Like the shot was, it needed polish, it needed cleanup, but it was there 100% in blocking. Is that efficient? I don't know. It just became the norm. And I'm pretty sure it still is.
Do you find it at the new studio that it's hard to adjust?
It's not hard to adjust. It's a different mindset. I think, you know, not to speak ill at any studio, my current place of employment, there seems to be a lot of the trust that, you know, they won't judge you based on your first block. So if you show it, it doesn't have to be perfect. It's okay if they just want to see the idea.
Yeah.
And they trust that you are competent because you're there to be able to do the work. And in other places, it's not always the case. Some places, you know, they're very judgmental, and I think they just, everything needs to be done and right the first pass. But the problem is you're wasting time. What happens if your idea isn't right? And you just spent 2 or 3 weeks that you should be spending doing something else. It comes down, I think, to a level of trust. And not feeling like you're being judged or judging someone all the time.
Mm.
That's, I think, what it honestly comes down to. For me, yeah, it's an adjustment. It's kind of peeling back the walls you've kind of built up over the years for what you used to. So it's an adjustment. I think it's a positive adjustment. I think it makes me feel kind of what I wanted to feel when I got out of school. So
yeah.
I'm happy right now.
The trust would be a comfortable feeling, but kind of also scary. It's like, it's nice that they trust you, but it's terrifying.
It is. But then again, it's not just you. You got to remember, there's a whole department, and when you see that everybody's showing what you're showing, and then nobody else is being crucified, you're like, okay, then this is a safe area. Like, I get it. They're out to get the best out of people without being, like, you know, backstabby. Like, they're in it for the craft and not about, like, you know, some producer in the back judging, I don't know, can just like, pull it off. I mean, that's literally what sometimes you can feel like in dailies in certain studios.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes down to trust, I think, a lot of the time.
So you developed a new workflow there, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about it and you know, how it's working out for you.
So yeah, it's interesting. Do you remember? It was. And I think for anybody that, I mean, it's not just Dreamworks. I think it's fair to say this is prevalent through the whole industry right now. it just become customary to, like, you know, get your shot, get the idea, get any notes you have, shoot reference, and then reproduce the reference best you can in the computer, which is fair. The thing is, it depends on the studio, depends on the artist you're working with. Some supervisors can be very controlling.
Yeah.
And then they might want to do the reference for you. They might be very picky about the reference you show. But at the same point, like, and I think I've talked to my students about this, if you stick too closely to the reference, all you get is the reference.
Yeah.
And that's fine if you're trying to reproduce stuff like that 100% for visual effects. And, you know, visual effects, I think they'd probably prefer to use mocap if they're going to do that stuff.
Yeah.
Not that I know. not speaking from experience. But I find that this new work method for me, it kind of mixes what I love, which is 2D, together with, like, the benefits of live action reference and CG. So I kind of just do a pass of the storytelling poses, which were my thumbnails. I just do those now in the computer with some really cool drawing tools. So I get to do that whole thing, time it out, do all that stuff in 2D. And if the stuff is a little bit more cartoony, then I can really play along with the shapes a little bit more in 2D. Then I'll block it in CG roughly. And it'll be very spread out, not very detailed. Then I would go with that information and do a reference pass. Like, I'll just shoot some reference based on that idea, see what feels loose, see how closely it matches to what I have in a pose and my blocking, and then adjust accordingly and then block out the whole shot based on the reference after that.
That's interesting. Do you think you?
It is.
Do you think you'll ever venture into that layered approach? You know, with, like, just starting with the hips or something like that and moving that around the screen and.
Oh, I've done that before, though. I mean, the example I gave you is mainly for the run-of-the-mill shots, you know, I would usually get, which are, you know, acting shots, some kind of dialogue shot. If it's a heavy mechanical shot, just a physics of you know, especially with you know, certain like flying creatures or quadrupeds.
Yeah.
I would always do those just on a layered method with the root first, because there's just so many legs and wings and tails, and that stuff you have to do a little bit more layered.
When you were at DreamWorks, you were an outreach speaker. Was that for students and stuff like that? You don't remember?
Oh, I would go. No, I mean, I would go do what I do to talk. When I would go to Israel, I would just go and do a talk every time, like a lecture for students. When I was at Sheridan, because it was out in the north, away from the Hollywood studios, didn't get a lot of talent coming. It wasn't like CalArts.
Right.
Where I think, you know, like when I was at DreamWorks, you would hear, like, you know, so-and-so went to stop at CalArts and so-and-so stopped at CalArts. So there'd be a lot of people.
Yeah.
And Sheridan didn't have that. We were so out of the way that I think once in a while they would fly someone up, but it'd be like, not everybody would have access to that person. It'd be like, they'll fly them out, only the second and third would have access or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. Excuse me. So it always kind of annoyed me. So when I went back to Israel, I realized that when I grew up there, there really was no access to those kind of people coming out there. So every time I go back, I would make an effort. I think it was some kind of talk somewhere. Had it been in a school, if it was a school, a studio, just to share information that I had learned on that film and talk about that and just spread knowledge as much as I can. Sometimes it fell on deaf ears, sometimes it fell on people that were really interested and inspired them to push themselves and then go to school and learn here or learn there, and you know, and that's great. It just depends on, you know, who wants to listen.
You're paying it forward all over the place.
I was in this for the feeling of it, like, and I've talked about this before, it's like when I see an animated movie that reminds me of what it was like when I was young to see a movie, I remember loving it, and it makes you feel like a kid again. It's like, you know, when I watch Land Before Time or something again, or American Tail, or I think I really like animation. Like, I'll watch it. Like, I think having kids is the best excuse I ever had for watching animation. And my wife is not like, again? You're watching again? You just saw the damn movie. So I really do like watching, and, you know, I really get into the art of it. So I kind of dig it when people, like, I can talk animation, just chat about it, ramble about it. I just love it. So watching people be inspired by it, just be into the art of it is cool to me. It really kind of inspires me and it energizes me more than anything. I'm a geek for that. Like, I am very much like, I grew up on a Disney cartoons, and I love that stuff. And I know I was very much, when I was a student, learning all the history of who did what, you know, who animated what. And I got really into that stuff, so it was cool.
So I know you've had mentors over the years, but do any of them come to mind right now? And what did they teach you?
Over the years? Well, for the most part, it's been one or two guys. At DreamWorks, it was mainly Rudolf Gennadin, who was kind of a soup on Panda 1. And then I'd worked with him on a few shows after that. He was really cool because, I don't know why, he was really patient with me. I was pretty stubborn in the beginning. I wasn't listening to him, not even a little. And he kind of stuck with me, though, for, I want to say it was 4 or 5 years. And he was pretty patient and really nice to me. And finally, I got it. And he only told me I got it more or less at the end of Panda 2, which means it was 5 years later, 5.5 years later. He's like, oh, you finally kind of got it. And I'm like, it only took 5.5 years. There you go. And it's cool. He was just someone that I knew I could show him something. And I wasn't, like, I know he wouldn't judge me for it. Like, you know, it's like sometimes you don't want to share your soup unless you're 100% sure it's ready.
Yeah.
And he was a soup, but he was also, he was just a really cool guy. And I really liked working with him. You needed a tough, you know, tough layer of skin to work with him. He was really into the banter stuff, which was fine. I didn't mind it.
The banter? You mean like yapping on?
The banter of just, you know, messing with you.
Okay.
Which is fine. But he also, I know if it wasn't for him, I probably wouldn't be the anime I am today. And then another guy that souped me on Panda 2 and then a little bit on Guardians, I was David Pate, and, you know, Both of them were very tough to work for, but they were very tough to work for, but they were also the two people I probably learned the most from.
Mm. That's cool. It's just because they were patient with you and stuck with you. They did nothing specific. It was just general animation.
Rudolph was patient with me. Dave was not so much, but I think with Rudolph it was more that he saw something, I think, and he was just trying to be patient with me because I was being stubborn, and he even said it, that I wasn't listening to what he was saying. It took a long time for me to be able to listen to him, and once I was able to listen to him, Pate was someone that could take it to like the next level of just challenging me, and I think he would probably even still say that I still haven't got it. challenging me to dig deeper than just the physical motion of it and what really motivates the performance, like thought, the kind of thing I kind of, try and drill into my students' head is have everything the character does be motivated by thought.
Yeah.
So they're just moving. And if they do move, why are they moving? And what initiates that motion?
Yeah.
That a lot of that stuff came from the both of them. And I think I am where I am today because of the both of them.
That's
and they're probably the best two drinking buddies you can have. Not that I ever drink that much with them, but they were pretty fun.
I didn't think you drank.
I don't. Not until I met them.
Oh, cool. So what are your thoughts on polish versus performance? Have you ever polished the performance out of a shot, and what are your tips for avoiding it? You've gone dead.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. I'm sorry.
Sometimes you can just polish a shot so much that you start to lose the performance in it. So if you're trying to make nice smooth arcs out of something, or make the brows a little bit smoother, maybe he was supposed to be angry, so his movements shouldn't be so smooth and arky. You've obviously never had that trouble.
No, I have. I know what you mean. There's definitely a place where things get too smooth or too soft, and you lose a little bit of the bite in an accent or something. To tell you that I've solved that, I don't think I have. I think it's a constant thing where as you get into the idea of polish so much and splatting that you fall in love with it, that sometimes you have to remind yourself while you're doing it, it's like, oh, wait a minute, this is supposed to be a little bit sharp. And then you kind of go in there and kind of adjust the curves to add it back in there. And then It just becomes a letter of kind of just play blasting it a little bit, and just getting sense of if it works or not. To be honest, when it comes to the polish level, I probably play blast way more than I do when I do my initial blocking. Like when I block, I don't play blast until it's done. The blocking's done. Mm. So it could be like a day or two that I'm blocking, and I will play blast it until it's done. But when it comes to actual polish, like the really finessing the facial stuff and all that kind of, even if it's like a hand gesture, like if it has a little bit more bite or snap to it, if it's pointing or something aggressive, I'll probably play blast that a little bit more aggressively just to make sure I get exactly what I want.
Yeah. Would you go more for performance rather than beautiful arcs, or arcs over performance?
Well, I mean, the arcs are beautiful if it gets the performance across. You know what I mean? Like, a beautiful arc doesn't necessarily mean it's always rounded to me. It's beautiful if it gets across what the character's trying to get across.
Yeah.
Because, again, I think one of those things that I was talking to you about, like, earlier in the previous question, in regards to especially Rudolph and Pate, it was the acceptance that animation was more than 12 principles of animation. It was more than squash stretch and the arcs and space and, ease in and ease out. It was performance first. And then the elements of the 12 principles go around to support that stuff. So, at a certain point, what you find, if you've been doing it long enough, I'm not going to say right, but you're doing it long enough, you find that hopefully it stops becoming, or you stop thinking of it as, oh, I'm going to hit this pose here, I'm going to hit this pose here, and I'll find a way to transition between the two. It becomes through, okay, what's the character thinking? Okay, well, how is he going to react in this situation? And the shot doesn't become so much of an animation, even though it can be still broad and cartoony or have some elements of it that are much more animated, but your whole mindset is much more character-driven, like character performance-driven.
Yeah. That makes sense. Very well answered, Tal.
let's hope it makes sense. It was one of those things where it was like, you're in school, and I was like, I want my teachers to tell me everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Hell if I would have understood a quarter of what they said, even if they knew it. Hell if I knew if they knew it. I mean, some of them were just like, you know, I don't know what they're doing for a living other than teaching. It was a time during the 2000s where everybody that could hold a pencil was working somewhere because it was insanely busy with, you know, I guess it was before 2000, it was like the 90s, where it was like Disney, DreamWorks, everybody was like Warner Bros., they were all going at it. So the point being, like, you could be a student, you could be like, I want all information. Will you understand it all?
Yeah.
Probably not. Do all pros understand it? Probably not. You know, with every evolution that you get better, you understand a little bit more.
Yeah.
And hopefully one day you will know a lot. Never all, but a lot.
Yeah, I was telling Keith today, I was doing one of the podcasts with him and Andrew Gordon's podcast, I think it was with John Carr's. I didn't understand that when I first listened to it. I was like, what in the name of God is he talking about? And then I went through Polish and Portfolio with Mark Oftedal, and with working and listening to podcasts back and forth between the two, it started to understand it in deeper and deeper levels, and it's actually gold. Whereas first I thought, that guy is talking out of his backside. You know what I mean? But it's actually amazing. I mean, so.
Don't get me wrong. There are people that definitely talk out their backside. I won't lie. I have been around animators that I'm like, okay, just shut up and animate. Like, that's literally my reaction. But that being said, they are the fancy pants that are trying to make it seem more hoity-toity than it is.
Yeah.
But there's an element of performance to it. There's an element of thought, and it's not just sit down and do it. It's sit down and think about it and then do it.
Mm.
But yeah, it's hard. It's freaking hard. It takes a lot of work, and it's, you know, like any art form, you know, to craft, it takes years to, I'm not even going to say master, I would say it takes years to get decent at it.
Yeah.
You know,
I know.
And hopefully, like, you know, if you could hear, oh man, I mean, I remember when I just got into DreamWorks, it was just like, you hear these, Rudolph would say stuff to me, I'm like, yeah. So, you know, more squat stretch, it's like, no, you idiot. I mean, he would, like, literally curse me out, it's like, no, you effing. I'm saying this, and I'm like, yeah. So, you know, more up and down, right? He's just like, yeah, go play in your sandbox, go ahead. I mean, it was just, like, pitiful, like. I wasn't able or willing to hear what he was saying. It was just the stubbornness of like, I get what you're saying. I totally understand it. So I'll just do this little thing that has no significance to what you're saying, but might imitate something that might mean what you're saying, you know, without understanding the concept of what he's saying. So you sometimes you're just not ready to hear it.
Mm. Well, that gives the rest of us hope, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I've been told by my mentors, and rightly so, to follow my own interests, but I feel you also have to consider the way the industry is going at the moment. So what would you suggest to people for them to stay flexible enough to work in various studios while finding their voice and staying true to themselves and their own aesthetic tastes?
I think that depends on the person, because...
Damn it, Tal. I want an answer to this. No, don't.
No, I'm gonna give an answer. I'm just going to say this. When I first got into this, I thought it was all about making movies. Like, because that's what I grew up seeing. It's like, I want to make those movies. Then you realize those movies aren't being made today.
Which, yeah. Yeah.
Once animated movies started making money, and then people are like, producers are like, execs are like, I can make money. I got no talent, but I can make money off people that actually have talent. Animated movies aren't what they used to be. No one makes those movies because those movies aren't profitable. I mean, one of my favorite movies of the last few years, I've mentioned this, is Paranorman.
Yeah.
That movie is phenomenal to me. It has very little marketing, like, very little bit, like, you know, product placement, all that stuff in there. And it also didn't do financially super well, but it's one of the most artistic. It's a movie that reminded me of the movies when I was growing up.
Yeah.
I thought it was fantastic. But almost nobody makes those movies except for, like, Leica. That's great for them, but nobody else makes those movies. So I found the joy in just doing my own stuff, and it's cool because it's just like I get to do what I like, and it's what I want to do, and it's why I love animation,
mm.
And I don't have to answer to anybody other than, you know, my wife. It's fine. It's just like, I get to do it. And if someone wants to work with me on it, we have fun and we animate and we learn together. And then, you know, I get to work on movies on a spare time, but sometimes, you know, at some point it might not be that. For other people, it might be games or something. I think you have to do what makes you happy as much as you can.
It's tough. It's tough. I mean, people have families, people have day jobs, they're trying to study and then trying to do what they like to do on the side. It can be really hard.
I mean, it's weird. People like the industry has never been worse. I mean, it's weird because it's tough out there now, but it's a lot more, it's very gypsyish kind of nation now where you literally have to pick up a move. Now, you get, a lot of people are like, well, that's fine with me. Like, I get to see the world. Well, that's great for you. But when you have a family and you're trying to raise those kids and not like military style and it's just like you want to have roots and everything, you can't pick up and leave and follow the work all the time.
Yeah.
So in that aspect, it's much worse than it was, you know, 5 years ago. But there's work out there. It's just spread out through the globe, unfortunately. So then you have to appease. So maybe you kind of sacrifice the work and you're like, okay, then I'll do X, Y, and Z. I'll do, you know, I'm not to belittle anything, any field.
Yeah, of course.
There's a lot more gaming studios, I mean, just in general than feature studios. So you don't do feature work. You go and you attempt to do gaming work, which is difficult in its own way. I don't belittle it at all. And then on the home, you do what makes you happy at home. I mean, you got to walk that balance sometimes, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a tough one to find.
Yeah, because if anybody thinks any industry cares about them, then they're mistaken. I've seen people that at feature studios, and they've been doing this for longer than I even held a pencil, I swear to God, and they're phenomenal. But the industry could be, you know, completely cruel to them, and they're not done yet. I mean, some of them still probably have another easily 20 years before retirement or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, a studio throws them out like they're nothing sometimes. So don't ever think that. I mean, I think we're all interchangeable, and I think we do this because we love this. But don't let the craft get mixed up with the industry. It's two separate things. Like, I love the craft. I kind of am okay with the industry sometimes. It's a love-hate relationship. But I think don't get those two things confused. Animation is amazing. I think feature animation, the quality of what we do is amazing. But it does not necessarily mean the film business is amazing.
Yeah. You learn that pretty quickly. You know,
I think a lot of students do, and I think it's even worse today because it is that thing where it's like the expectations from people that come out of school today is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I have students, and I don't expect either one of them to finish school and be like, now you could produce absolutely stunning, gorgeous animation of 5 feet a week. It's difficult enough for the pros, and I think, you know, there needs to be a little bit of perspective when it comes to that stuff.
Well, let's hope. So, in the early stage, you look very worried there. You're like, uh-oh.
No, I'm good.
In the early stages for young animators, Tal, would you suggest quantity over quality? By that, I mean students labor over their shots, and in the end, these don't tend to be, like, they're not going to be on their reel. They're not going to be as good as shots that they do later months or later in years. So do you think it's better in the early days to go bash through a whole load of shots that aren't necessarily going to be on their reel? Or would you have them labor over a few? Or maybe what the benefits you think would be of doing both cases?
Well, you're not going to like this answer.
Pardon?
You're not going to like this answer because, again, it depends on what is your weakness, I think. Like, again, if you're showing your reel around and someone's telling you, okay, and you're getting a lot of consensus that you're weak at, let's say, X, which could be mechanics, or you're just really weak at the mechanical side of executing a shot, like spline, or you're just not very good at performance, just your acting is just really off. I think doing small, not necessarily even shots, but exercises and that kind of stuff, could benefit you. It's like flexing a muscle. It's like if you're lifting weights, you don't have to do it's just doing small reps, short reps will help build it bigger, basically. And it would make you, you might not have a lot to show, but it would help you, your tool set, be more defined and you being a little bit more confident in executing a shot. Yes, then you can go easily more quickly do a shot for your reel or something. Then laboring over the same shot for 4 months, you know, trying to polish it, it's like, okay, you can get it where it looks good. But then when you get to a studio, you don't have 4 months to do a shot,
yeah.
Especially not a small one.
Yeah.
So it's not really that you're helping yourself. You might think you are by getting in the studio, but if you leave a bitter taste in the studio's mouth, they're not going to forget it that soon. So I think it's better to do shorter exercises that focus on kind of what might be your weakness. And trust me, everybody has a few. That is the one. And then, you know, trying to work those out as best you can.
Mm. So this is a bit of a sad question, but I think we all go through it. This sort of, I'm not good enough. I've had a few friends recently that have decided on giving up being an animator, either giving up completely or giving up, you know, the idea of working in features. And it got me thinking. I've talked to a lot of people over the years that, and as far as I can remember, they've all said that they were the best in their class. And I think that perhaps encouragement and a certain amount of confidence has a lot to do with success. So what about the rest of us? I mean, I wasn't the best in my class. You know, you look at animators nowadays and the talent, the level getting into the industry is so high, and you see people getting out of it straight out of school, and you're just like, can I get there? It's sometimes really hard, and I hate to think people giving up.
I feel like that every day. Because you kind of live and die by your shot. Like, if you have a really good day in your shot, you're like, God, I'm awesome. Rock star. If something's not working, you're like, God damn, I suck. I suck. They're gonna fire me. They're gonna find out that I've sucked forever. How I got here, I have been sucking for years. I mean, right? Everybody goes through that. Every single animator. I'm sure there's a few that are really egotistically like, no, I'm absolutely posh and awesome. I think for the most part, we're all a little bit like, I suck. And I think those that stick it out, those that succeed, I think they're those that are committed to it. And I mean that they really want it. And there's also a lot of luck involved, I'm not going to lie. It's not just all wanting it and talent. A lot of it is also luck. Being in the right place at the right time always plays a part in everything in life. So I knew a guy in school, one of the best in our year, extremely talented. We graduated, and he didn't get a job right away, so he went back to school. And he's talented at everything, so he's lucky. But I don't know what he would have been today had he stuck it out or tried to stick it out, but he didn't. Yeah. And I think it's more of a case where other people that were maybe not as talented as him stuck it out, and they achieved more just because they were willing to stick it out and see where it led them, and they worked continuously hard at it. Maybe those that it comes easy to aren't willing to, it comes easy to them, so it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
It was never easy for me, and it was always a challenge, especially the drawing aspect of it. It was kind of like, I really couldn't imagine doing anything else, which is a good thing and a bad thing, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, this is what you love, and it's like, I want to do this, and I'm not going to stop until, not I get here, but until I get this good, and that's never going to happen, so it's just never going to end.
Yeah, it was the same for me. I felt like I would be happier always trying to achieve this and never getting it rather than being an accountant, which was I was before. So.
Yeah, but at the same time, like you said, you get a family stuff, you got to be realistic. So,
absolutely.
It's a balance. I mean, to be honest, I've known guys that have done this a long time and they were good and they did it and they've worked on some big films in 2D and in CG.
Mm.
And then they were done. And then it was like the industry said, you're done. And then he was like, well, I got to switch a career. And I've seen him do that. You just never know where it's going to take you. The funny thing is you don't know many old animators. That's a little bit scary.
Yeah, I know. And it's terrifying because some of the most amazing ones out there still get chopped pretty quickly. And
yeah. I mean, you know some of the older ones for the 2D. They're doing okay because they're around for those nice golden wars. But the rest of us slackers are going to be working for a long time, and let's hope the industry still likes us 20, 30 years from now.
Okay, I hope so. Do you think it's important, certainly at the studio you're working at right now, I remember before it used to be important to have a short film on your reel. Is that still the case?
I don't know. I think it's interesting. It seems that a lot more studios now, because a lot of stuff is looking, especially with online schools, are looking a lot more similar. A lot of students kind of want to see your point of view, I think is the right term.
Yeah.
Who you are as an animator. So I think a little bit of professional work, just to show that you're an industry professional or have been at something, good work, is always a bonus. But some of them would rather see a mixed, a personal message in animation from you rather than pointless, you know, repetitive shots that are very similar.
Yeah.
So if you could have, like, you know, on a 2-minute reel, if you have like 2 or 4 shots of production worthy stuff, that's great, maybe even 5. And then have, you know, the rest of it be personal work that's still really good but says something about you as an animator. I think that could go over really well. It just, if it's personal and it describes who you are and you get to put a little bit, it just also says a little bit something about you. Because let's be honest, for a reel there's only so much you can judge.
Yeah.
You never, I mean, I've talked with so many professional animators about this. You never know what you're looking at, even in a pro's reel. Because you never know, like with students especially, you never know how long they spend on the shot. Like you said, it could be 4 months, it could be 2 weeks. You never know.
Yeah.
So it's hard to judge how they would work in a production environment. Even with pros, you never know how much work that animator got from a supervisor, how much work went into fixing it, what it was initially like before the storyboards. And you would be surprised how much lighting effects and fur and render all hide a lot of mistakes. So you never know.
Yeah. People have played a huge role in my career. And a lot of times animators can be really, really shy. I certainly was at the start. What did you say, really?
I said really?
I was. I used to work for Chuck Gamage, and he used to throw me at Chuck Gamage, yeah. And he used to throw me... What?
In Toronto?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Why? Did you work for him too?
No, I interviewed for him right out of school, and he was kind of like... me and my family interviewed him, and we're like... Because we knew him, because he'd worked, you know, on Baby Herman, and he had some stuff from other features. And he was like, the place to work, and we went in for the interview, and he's like, sure, let's get this guy some work. And we're like, yeah. And then his head animator was like, we don't have any work to give them. And we're like,
ugh.
So it never went anywhere, so that was kind of sucky. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're right. It actually took me about 3 months to get a job with Chuck. And eventually he's like, oh, okay. He's what?
He's a character.
He is. He's lovely. I love him to pieces. But he took me to Ottawa Animation Festival anyway, and he just threw me in front of people. I remember he introduced me to Richard Williams. I was so shy. And he called me over and he goes, Sandra, this is Richard. Richard, this is Sandra. Okay. And just walked off. And I was like,
yeah.
Oh my God. And he'd do that all the time. So that kind of got me out of my shyness. But anyway, do you think it's important for animators to put themselves forward and sort of get to know people, and, you know, does it not necessarily to change your career, but I suppose just the way we're being able to converse and learn from each other and stuff?
Well, I think that kind of falls to what we were talking about earlier, where it's like a little bit of luck, that it, you could be good, but the studios just want to know if you are, or for lack of a better word, a dick. Like, they want to know that if you come in, you will blend well, and you will not be a problem in production. You won't be a prima donna. And getting to know people is I think is important. Will that replace good work? Probably not. If you're a nice person and you do good work, you should be okay. But the problem is, I don't know that. Knowing the right person is going to help you that much. Like, for instance, it does help, let's say, if you have a friend who's looking for work, and then you know that someone is, you know, might be hiring, let's say, and you're like, oh, I know so-and-so, and he's a straight-up guy, and you can vouch for him, saying he's a... They will look at his reel and be like, okay, this guy has professional work, and I have, like, 1 or 2 people saying that he's a good person.
Yeah.
They'll take him a little bit more seriously, I think. But I know people that don't know any... But they get a job at the feature studios.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that chasing down people and getting to know them and making sure they know who you are and all that stuff, I'm sure it's beneficial in a certain way. I don't know if it's super beneficial in our industry.
Mm.
Just because in the end, your reel does most of your talking. Maybe not all of it, but most of it.
Yeah. You gave me some great advice on how to handle myself in dailies. As a newbie in the industry, can you reiterate for the listeners? Because I think it's really valuable for the general public. And you know what I'm talking about, so go ahead. You know, I asked you in class about, you know, a new person going into the studio and how to handle themselves and dailies and so on. And you, you told me just to sit back and see what the atmosphere was happening around us and stuff. And...
Is that what I said? What the hell? How ridiculous is that to say? I just think it's don't be the person that tries to explain their shot in 5 minutes. Just, you know, usually it's say something, describe what it is, and let it be that. Just sit back, take the notes. Don't say, I haven't done that yet. Don't just sit back and just take the notes and be like, yes, very, you know, cheery, happily. Knowing that the notes you are getting are making your shots better.
Yeah.
Knowing that not everything that you think you know. And that the people in the room with you are trying to make the shot all that it, that could be, but all it needs to be for the film, hopefully. Mm. Hopefully. It might not be your fault. And just be very respectful and understand that, you know, hypothetically, we're all there to make the movie together. That's all I meant.
Would you have any advice for how to get to know your hokas and your supervisors and for them to get to know you?
No, I have no advice for that. I have no clue. I have no clue. I just don't. I find that when you try to talk up your hokas or your, like, your soups, and it's like you have nothing in common. It's like that awkward silence on a date where it's like, we shouldn't be here together. So it's kind of that thing where it's like, yeah, you're my soup, but I got nothing to say to you, man. It's just like, it's awkward. It's like, hey, how you doing? Okay, how you doing? Good? Yeah, nice. I got nothing. It just depends on you. Usually, if there's alcohol involved, it goes a little bit smoother. So if it's like a Thursday night or a Friday night and it's 5 o'clock, you know, you crack a bottle open, it will probably go a little bit better. On a daily basis, I don't know.
Okay, I was landed with my current soup at lunchtime. I didn't know who he was. My friend was supposed to meet me for lunch. She sent him instead. That was how I got to know my current soup.
I mean, it's okay to sit and talk to them, and when it flows, it flows. It's just, when you're trying to force it, it could also send a negative vibe to those people.
Mm.
So, if it's like, you know, kismet, and it's like, oh, we just ended up at the same place at the same time, we should hang out and talk about something random. That's fine. Don't chase them down to talk to them. If it happens, it happens.
Yeah. Cool. And so I guess we have to talk about how not to overanimate things.
You're talking to a person, really. She's really thinking. I have not learned that lesson yet. I'll tell you what.
You give it to me a lot about this in class, and I just want, now I can say, you know, it's not fair because you do the exact same thing.
What do you mean? What do I do? What do I do?
Overanimate. You're an animation addict.
I overanimate?
Right? Yeah.
I overanimate, but I'm aware that I overanimate. There's a difference. Like, that I do that, it's like a sickness, and I'm fighting it back with, like, you know, the animation addict side of me is like, I know that I'm an addict to it, and I fight it. So it's kind of like, I have all these guards in place, so I use reference, so I don't over, you know, do a motion with my hand and you know, follow through this and follow through that. I have all these things in place that stop me from doing that every time I get my shot. You know, every time I look at the shot, I kind of look at it and I'm like, okay, is that overdone? Yeah, let's delete that. So I do it, but I'm aware, and that's the first step. So I'm at least fighting the fight. My problem is those people that don't care and they're just doing it because they think it looks good.
So it's a case of just being honest with yourself and saying, is this really what the shot needs, or is it going over the top?
I don't know if it's honest with yourself. I think it's being critical with yourself because, you know, honest with yourself, you might be like, yes, honest, yeah, but I like it. Mm. Critical is like, yeah, but does the shot need it? And the shot usually don't. So you don't put it in.
That's cool. I guess your soup policy too, huh?
Sorry?
Your supervisor will help you too? Or
unless they're addicts like you and they are all into it. You never know.
Oh, God. What was your most challenging shot so far and why? I wish people could see those big wide eyes darting around the room.
I don't know.
Really?
Hold on. I don't know.
Really? Wow. Come on.
No, I don't. I mean, each shot has a technical level of complexity to it, and then there's a performance area to it, but, I mean, it's weird. Stuff that other people might think it's complicated, like was a little bit, like, for instance, on Guardians, Rise of the Guardians, animating Sophie was complicated. I mean, it wasn't complicated. It wasn't as easy, I think, to get right for other people because it was a little girl. But just because based off my daughter, it was, like, I had, almost, like, a quick sketch for her. It became really second nature to animate her.
Yeah.
So for me, it wasn't too bad. I think maybe on Panda 2, there was some stuff that was a little bit more difficult, I would say. Just because it was finding a balance between naturalistic and a little bit more broad in the performance and still making it unique. But I have a hard time picking out one shot, to be honest with you.
Okay.
They all seem like a pain in the ass, just in general.
Well, that's encouraging to hear.
Don't worry. I don't know a lot of people that it's easy for them. I don't know if anybody, like, if any animators are out there interviewing saying, yeah, it's super easy. I don't know, but, like, when I'm walking through any studio and just see people's frustrations in their shots and getting notes all the time, I don't think that for anybody it's easy.
Mm. Well, how do you deal with directors or soup's notes that you heavily disagree with?
I walk outside screaming and kicking and yelling and crying a little bit. I come back 15 minutes later and I change it.
Do it.
Because they're the boss and in the end, their notes make the shot better. Hopefully.
And how do you keep...
Listen, it's personal work. You want it to be yours, but at the same time, it's part of, you know, a puzzle, and that puzzle has to maintain its cohesiveness. You know, it has to maintain the same style and look as the other, you know, pieces. And you might not always have a view of this giant puzzle, but just your little piece. And it's important to make sure that there's someone out there that, you know, that their job is to keep it all cohesive. And it's your job as a professional to understand that, accept that, and adjust the work accordingly and move on.
Yeah. Cool. How do you keep your work-life balance? You've got a wife, kids, a dog, a job, the site, Pay It Forward.
I say that I have, since I've started the new place employment, I have not worked on personal stuff at home.
No.
So once I leave work, I leave work, and I'm home, and that's it. So if things settle down, I will plan to start something personal, but even then, I'll probably be a little bit more selective about making sure it's absolutely when everybody's sleeping. And it's on my own, you know, time, but you just have to cut the cord at some point. That's work and that's personal life, and accept that at some point that stuff has to happen.
Yeah. Hopefully you'll be happier for it. It seems like,
hopefully.
You know. So now you're teaching at iAnimate, but you've been teaching way back at IDT, you know, developing the curriculum and...
I did a bit of training there, and I got to be honest... that was very different. I wouldn't say that I became a teacher until I started iAnimate, to be completely honest.
Mm. Was it always in your blood? Is it something you always wanted to do?
It's something that I always wanted to do, but I think building up the confidence of just being able to sit in front of people and really talk animation and instruct them in a certain way happened. It took maybe a year, even at iAnimate, until I felt comfortable doing it properly.
Mm.
It took a while, and I think now I feel very comfortable doing it. And also, it's not fair to the students sometimes because I don't share everything with them, but it's that same thing where I don't think they always are ready for everything at once, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I can say a lot of stuff, and I can give you all the notes in your shot at once, but you probably won't address all of them. So it's kind of you learn these tricks, and you become more comfortable, and it's not as scary to speak in public and do all this stuff. So with time, you get more comfortable, but I've always wanted to do it, but I think I've only become decent at it in the last, or good at it in the last 2 or 3 years.
I'm laughing with you, not at you there.
No, you're laughing at me.
Is there a particular mistake you've seen going through the reels over the year, like more recently? Yeah.
What do you mean mistakes?
Like certain things that people do a lot before, I guess it was, you know, the motion was there, but there was no real acting behind it. And
that's still the same thing, though.
Still?
Changed. It's just in general. It's not just any school. It's every school and every student. Trying to get people, I mean, it's also professionals. Trying to get people to think about what they're doing is like, people want to show how beautifully they do stuff as compared to why it's supposed to be doing it. So I think I've talked about this. It's just like, with my students at least, when you have two characters doing something, both characters move the same. Well, why the hell would they move the same? I mean, why? And you, like, I remember when I was at the CTN 2 years ago, I saw so many reels and they all look the same. It's because they're all the same. People put no thought into what they're doing. They're just moving. They think they're thinking about it by, oh, dude, this guy acting like this, but who is this guy? Why is he moving like this? What's the motivation for this? Why does he move like this and this character would move like this? All these things have reason and purpose and need to be thought of. And people, they're always in a rush. They're always in a rush to get the shot to their reel, not understanding that there is life beyond the reel. There's life beyond getting accepted to the studio. You actually have to do the damn work. So there's a lot of work involved in what we do, and taking the time to think about it is a huge benefit.
Mm. Cool. We're down to two questions, Tao.
Yay!
Well, that's very nice of you.
I got kids screaming outside.
Okay. Do you want to go now then? You can show
us. No, it's okay. Let's do this.
Okay, well, the two simple ones, I think. What is the greatest piece of advice someone has ever given you that really you feel really helped you in your animation career?
Have fun. Suck less.
Was that...
I kid you not. That was what the hook on Panda said. He's just like... He told the whole group, he's like, have fun and suck less. I'm like...
That sounds good.
That's good. I'll take it.
Yeah. Is there something you wish you'd known at the start when you were starting out that you feel would have made it easier or could have dealt with the whole thing better?
Animation?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish I knew how to do it. If I knew how to do this when I started 13 years ago, I'd be way better today. Yeah, I mean, it took a little, you'd be surprised how long it took to... the whole thought thing, it took a long time for it to click. Mm. That stuff is motivated by thought. There is a reason for why things move the way they do. And it's still a tough thing. So I wish I would have thought about that more in a way that I could implement it correctly into my work earlier.
Cool. So there you go. There you have it. Is there
we're done.
That's it, yeah. Is there anything that you want to clarify?
I would say to the people listening, if they're listening, suck less, and understand that this is an awesome thing to do and watch and enjoy, and that I think it's not 100% always appreciated by people outside the medium, but I don't always do it for them, and you know, sometimes I do it for me because I love it, and sometimes that needs to be enough.
Yeah, that's good advice. That's good advice.
Hopefully.
Well, thanks so much. You're always really sincere and honest with your advice, and I really appreciate it. I'm sure everybody else will too. So
I hope so. Let me know how it turns out.
I'll send it to you. I promise before I publish it. And well, listen, enjoy the rest of your holidays and good luck everything.
Thanks and good luck to you. What's up coming up with you? Well, hopefully, let me know how it goes.
Yeah, I will, of course. All right.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks a million, Tao. Good night.
Absolutely. Bye.
Bye.